A new airport runway and modernized hospital emergency rooms. Both could use borrowed money to pay for them. Borrowed in your name. Borrowed in the public's name. From a new runway at Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport to updated emergency rooms at Jackson Health System, these multi-million dollar projects are paid for by IOUs. I'm Tom Hudson. Coming up on the Sunshine Economy, we owe you public debt in South Florida. Florida's state credit rating is better than that of the nation's. But what about the big promises made to current and future retirees? How do those pledges impact with the public mayo in the years to come? Uncle Sam has stepped up policing of IOUs issued in the public's name. It's all ahead on the Sunshine Economy, next on WLRN. This is the Sunshine Economy. We owe you public debt in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. For anyone traveling at just the right time on I-95, just south of the 595 interchange, you recognize that sound. It's the roar of a Southwest Airlines Boeing 737 on final approach, just seconds away from landing on runway 10 left, 28 right at Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport. Driving on I-95 there, look to the west. You'll see those pinpricks of white lights lining up over western Broward County. Planes getting in line to land at the airport, making final preparations to touch down, bringing another group of passengers into South Florida.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to welcome you to Fort Lauderdale. We'll be taxiing for the next few moments, so please remain seated with your seat.
By the end of next year, you should be able to see two sets of white lights lining up west of I-95, thanks to a new south runway and thanks to hundreds of millions of dollars of public debt. IOUs, bonds, debt, whatever you want to call it, it's borrowed money that has to be paid back. Who's doing the lending? Well, big pension funds, insurance companies, mutual funds, certainly, but also small investors like Mal Greenfield from Tallahassee.
My wife was brought up on Miami Beach. We had a house in Miami. We lived in Miami as husband and wife from 1957 until 1967, when we moved to Miramar.
You still invested in South Florida. If you're a Miami-Dade County taxpayer, you owe Mal money. If you do business or travel through Port Everglades in Fort Lauderdale, you help pay Mal back. He's just one of the lenders in the huge market for IOUs for local and state governments and agencies. We'll hear more from Mal a little bit later on in this program. Now, in Washington this week, Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives and President Obama have just a few days left now to raise the amount of money the federal government can borrow in the public's name or risk not being able to pay all of the government's debts on time. There are some who argue the Constitution's 14th Amendment states the validity of America's debt shall not be questioned. But as a practical matter, unless the Treasury Department gets a higher credit limit from Congress by Thursday, payments, and we don't know which ones, will likely be delayed. Flipping through the prospectus for $450 million in IOUs sold to investors just a week ago by the Broward County Aviation Department's Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport. Hundreds and hundreds of pages of financial tables, charts, descriptions of the airport's operations, all in an effort to attract investors to buy the bonds, essentially lend money to the airport in order to continue what is a $2.3 billion expansion project that includes that second runway, but also renovating a terminal, building a new concourse, a new baggage system, and other improvements. The end loaders are out busy pushing dirt and gravel around. There's a concrete plant that's actually been built right on site. After all, almost a half million cubic yards of the stuff will be poured to build that second runway. And paving is on schedule to begin this month. All of this paid for with borrowed money, to be paid back over 30 years. Paid back, though, not with property taxes, but by the business generated at the airport itself.
I would not want to be pricing the bonds, you know, today or next week.
That was Doug Wolf last week at his office in Dania Beach. He's the chief financial officer for the Broward Aviation Department. It was his job to sell the latest batch of bonds to raise the money used for the airport construction. He got it done. Did you ever consider postponing this bond sale because of what was going on in Washington?
Good question. We talked about that a lot. And obviously, this has been on our radar screen for months. We were ready to go as quickly as we could because we wanted to beat all this. And right, it was on everybody's radar screen. And I think we hit it right. You know, you think of the risk of waiting. You know, if there were a default, the market would be 10 times worse than what we sold into. We sold into a difficult market. We sold 30-year bonds. This airport has an excellent credit story to tell. We are on a growth trajectory. We're making these just really solid improvements. There was less fear in buying our credit than there was actually in some of these short-term treasury securities. So
it's a significant statement, though, to say that lenders in the market, buyers of your bonds, had or have perhaps more faith in the credit of the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport to generate the revenue to pay back these bonds plus interest than they do in the federal government and the American taxpayer and the full faith and credit of the U.S. government.
Some people felt that way, you know, and you clearly we had some buyers, like I mentioned previously, who big bond funds who weren't participating because they just didn't know what was going to happen, clearly on the short term. Now, long term, I think a lot of the bond funds, you know, PIMCO, they manage a couple $1 trillion of assets. You know, they publicly have said, the guy who manages that fund publicly has said they haven't changed their investment procedures at all. But, you know, everybody has an opinion, but you know, actually, PIMCO bought some of our bonds, believe it or not. But, you know, there were big buyers of our bonds, like I mentioned, who weren't participating because they had a different perspective on that.
What was the role of the credit of Broward County in this offer to raise essentially $500 million this year, raised over $500 million last year?
The credit of Broward County government is not involved in this selling these bonds. There are no tax dollars that are involved in this financing. No property tax, no sales tax, zero. It is all based on the users' fees that this airport generates from the operation, the tenants, the users of this airport. So there's no involvement from Broward County.
Arguably, Broward County residents who fly through Fort Lauderdale, either to take off to go on a vacation or to come back on a business trip, will be paying those fees and will be part of that mechanism to pay back your lenders.
Right. Yes. What they do is they will pay. You know, we have local residents who pay to park here. They buy food and gifts inside our terminal, so all that generates income for the airport. But, you know, I will tell you that even raising, you know, about $1 billion in the last year, that this airport and the airlines that serve this airport, our average round-trip airfare, we are among the top five lowest in the entire country, is at this facility. And it has historically been that way because of the airlines that serve this community. You have Southwest, you have JetBlue, you have AirTran, Spirit. Those are all low-cost airlines. And our average round-trip airfare is among the top five lowest in the entire country. So, and we intend to keep it that way.
You're about two-thirds to the goal of the amount of money that you're going to raise from lenders. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the project, there'll be a significant physical asset. And in the municipal bond market, the public debt market for local governments and local issuing agencies of these kind of bonds, that's traditionally the case. There's a physical asset. In this case, it'll be a runway, and it will be terminal improvements and allow more capacity for the airport. And that's ultimately what you're borrowing against here, right?
This is a growth airport. We're building for the growth that the airlines are going to be experiencing here at this airport. This trajectory is that what we're seeing here in this community, the passengers, is just phenomenal. For example, the JetBlue is going to be increasing their presence here next year by almost a full fourth. They have a 24% increase in their the number of departures. The number of seats that are being sold for international departures is going to be up about 8% year over year. So there's going to be tremendous growth in this facility.
Doug, I want you to match up the interest costs that you've experienced, the higher interest costs this week selling the series of bonds versus what you sold last year, and the growth that's necessary to be able to pay those lenders back in time.
A year ago, we raised over $600 million in bonds, and what we call the all-in true interest cost on those bonds of 3.97%. This year, we did the same thing, but we were at 4.90%. So it cost us almost one full additional percentage to borrow the money this year than compared to last year. And that's because of what's happened in the market. The bottom line for the airport and the airlines is what we call cost per emplanement. That's the cost that, on average, the airlines pay for every passenger who gets on an airplane.
That's what the airline pays to the airport.
Right, correct. They don't literally write us a check for every person that gets on, because this is made up of things like rent for various facilities and the landing fees and so on. It's a little more complicated than that. But the measure is, what are they paying on average? Okay. Now, right now, it's a little bit more than $4. Next year it'll be about four. We're projecting $4.13 next year.
What contributes to that increase? Is it the increase in rent, for instance, that you can charge?
What caused that slight, and that is a very slight increase in their costs, was the additional debt that we incurred as we're going through this construction. Now we're building up these assets, right, and we're spending money to construct them, but they're not open yet, so they're not generating any revenue. Now, the projection is, and we follow this very closely, we've spent a lot of time on this, is prospectively that $4.13 is at a peak when we get all of this capital improvements done. In the year 2018, our peak will be about $7.70. So now the national average for large hub airports is anywhere from, depending on who you talk to, is anywhere from $10 to $12 per passenger.
So still below the national average, but a significant increase from where you're even at today.
Yeah, but we'll be about 20 to 25% lower than what the national average is. One of the things that's really going to help us pay for all these improvements, or that we talked about, the terminal improvements, we are going to be completely revising our concession program. Mm-hmm.
These are the restaurants and newsstands inside the airport.
Correct. And to date, the facilities are fairly dated. Yeah, they were designed and built, in the late 70s, built in the early 80s. They're basically almost functionally obsolete, from a concessions perspective. And we anticipate that the sales that we're going to get from our concessions are going to go a long way to keep our costs down, because that's going to generate revenue.
How much of it comes from the airlines themselves, those passenger fees, and how much of it comes from the concessions and the coffees and the bagels that we are purchasing as we're waiting for the planes?
The industry average for large hub airports is airline revenue makes up approximately 50% of the total revenue that large hub airports get. So it's about a dollar-for-dollar mix, okay? In our example, it's actually less than 30% is coming from the airlines, and 70% is coming from our concessions, our parking, those sorts of things, what we call non-airline revenue.
Let me ask you about that mix, 70% from concessions, 30% from passenger fees. As you continue to go to the market and borrow more money next year and that passenger fee increases, does that mix then change a little bit?
Actually, the 30% doesn't come from passengers. The 30% comes from the airlines and paying for their landing fees and their rents.
Arguably, that comes from ticket fees that they charge, ticket fares they charge from passengers.
Of course it does, yeah. Of course. As we go forward, that mix, because I talked about our concessions, we're investing heavily in our concessions. And to date, honestly, we have been very much an underachiever in that regard.
For the residents of Broward County, what's the return on investment that you are making essentially in their name at this Fort Lauderdale Hollywood International Airport to the tune of $1.5 billion of borrowing over between last year, this year, and next year?
That's an interesting question for a governmental entity, because the reason is that now we are on when you look at our income statement, we are making anywhere from about $65 to $70 million a year is the profit. Now that profit is redeployed back into this facility to keep the costs low. Okay, now we've got a lot of objectives here, and every governmental entity does. Now we're a little bit easier to measure than general government, but our responsibility is to keep our costs low and to promote air service to this community. That's really why we're here. When you think about it, you've got safety and security for the passengers. The other main responsibility we have is to do what we can to promote air service to this community.
And it's been working. Over half of all domestic airline passengers flying in and out of South Florida are coming through the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport. Now, remember Mal Greenfield, the municipal bond investor from Tallahassee who owns public debt from all over?
Some in Texas, some in Tallahassee, some in Illinois, some in Oklahoma, some in Missouri, some in Colorado, some in the actual state of Washington.
So here's how tuned in he is to public borrowing. On Thursday last week, he calls my mobile phone to tell me, "Hey, Tom, some new bonds just hit the market from the Fort Lauderdale Airport." I said, "Mal, I'm sitting in the lobby of the Broward County Aviation Department waiting to speak with its chief financial officer." All right, still to come on this edition of the Sunshine Economy, a different kind of public debt will be on the ballot for Miami-Dade County voters next month, an IOU for Jackson Health System backed up by homeowners' property taxes.
Over the last 2.5 years, we have Jackson being marginally profitable. We made $8 million last year, and this September 30th, we'll probably be closer to $40 million surplus. But that's not enough to do the improvements that are necessary at Jackson.
This is the Sunshine Economy. We owe you public debt in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. The main entrance lobby at Jackson Memorial Hospital doesn't have the bustle and stress of the ER, but there's still a steady stream of people coming through the automatic sliding doors, asking to see a doctor, checking in, being directed to the different departments a large hospital like Jackson offers. Just 3 years ago, the facility was in financial straits with hundreds of millions of dollars in unpaid bills all piled up. It was losing money each year, threatening the hospital with bankruptcy. It was running low on cash and low on morale. The Public Health Trust, the quasi-government agency that runs the system, was under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission over a 2009 public bond sale. More on that coming up in a minute.
We have taken, and we've created accountability, we've created the controls that are necessary at Jackson.
That's Carlos Magoya, the guy who has led the turnaround at Jackson, reversing the losses, addressing problems with the hospital's financial reporting, and is now asking Miami-Dade County voters for the okay to borrow $830 million. If successful in November, the loans would be earmarked to modernize the facility, build a new children's care center, a new physical rehabilitation hospital, and construct neighborhood urgent care centers. In Magoya's words, make the third largest public hospital system in the nation more competitive.
In order for us to continue to work on the mission of Jackson, which is to provide the great quality of health care that we provide for all Miami-Dade residents, whether they can afford it or not, we need to make sure that we're competitive. And we want to make sure that people look at Jackson not just when their life depends on it or when they have no other choice, but as a hospital of choice. So all the traditionally insured patients. The only way to do that is today the facilities are 30 years old. We have some of the best doctors in the country, some even say in the world. But the problem that we have by having old facilities, sometimes the people look at the facility and say, "No, it's an old hospital. I'm going to try to go to a new hospital." If we start really focusing on being able to get insured patients to help offset some reductions of Medicaid, this is a continued way of how we can continue to grow and rely less on taxes for the future. So it is a one-time investment that hopefully will have less reliance on taxes for the future.
Magoya and Jackson want the loans backed by property taxes in Miami-Dade County to get more insured patients through the door. As a public hospital system, Jackson treats all kinds of patients from all income levels. A third of its business comes from Medicaid. the state-administered federal health plan for low-income Americans.
So the idea with this $830 million in bonds that would be backed by taxpayers, property taxpayers in Miami-Dade County, the hope is Jackson Health Systems can go after insured patients and reduce the reliance that it's had on non-insured or Medicaid and Medicare patients.
That is correct because of the reduction of Medicaid. People talk about Obamacare as a way of Medicaid expansion. They don't realize that the federal government is not looking to increase their expenses. They can't afford to. As we know, there's a huge deficit already. There's a debt ceiling, and there's a lot of problems from the federal government. So they're borrowing from one side to pay the other. So if you look at it from on Jackson gets, as a public hospital, gets supplement to that Medicaid, $200 million a year. That number will go away with Obamacare. If we get Medicaid expansion in the state of Florida, the increment of Medicaid patients that don't have it today is about 75 million. Therefore, the difference, 125 deficit, will be impact Jackson. The only way to do that and continue to succeed in the future as an academic hospital is to be able to offset that with insured patients.
So what is the revenue mix currently for Jackson Health Systems between Medicaid, Medicare, non-insured, and insured?
Okay, so 3 years ago when we got here, 2.5 years ago, we were a little over 20% indigent. We're down to 13% uninsured.
Does that mean no insurance whatsoever?
No insurance whatsoever. That's about half of it is undocumented aliens, and the other half are poor people that don't qualify under Medicaid expansion, under Medicaid, which means in the future with Medicaid expansion they would. But that's 13%. What we did is many of the poor people qualify for Medicaid. They didn't know it. So as they come in the door at Jackson, we help them qualify. That's how we reduce it from 20 to 13. 35% is Medicaid. There's another 16-17% is Medicare, and the rest of it is traditional insurance between HMOs and traditional insurance companies.
And the idea here is to grow that HMO and traditional insurance company.
Correct. So obviously we're not looking to shy away from Medicaid. We just can't afford to have it at the 35%. So if we grow our insured patients, we'll be able to continue to do that and then have less reliance on taxes in the future.
What is a sustainable level of indigent, non-insured, and Medicaid that you'd like to see in the mix of Jackson Health revenue?
A traditional hospital, in order for it to be sustainable, Medicaid has to be no more than 25%, and the indigent has to be somewhere between 8 and 10%. And instead of reducing what we do today, what we need to do is increment our revenues with the insured patients to be able to make that happen.
You're looking to grow that insured as opposed to reduce necessarily the number of patients you've
That's
got
correct.
On Medicaid rather than in indigent care.
That's correct. So we can have less reliance on Medicaid and the fluctuations of Medicaid in the future. Medicare will also have some reductions, by the way, as we go forward. But that, you know, we'll deal with one issue at a time. But what we are talking with this bond is over the next 3 years, we need to make sure that we modernize the entire plant, that we have brand new patient rooms, that we have brand new operating rooms, emergency rooms, intensive care units.
Let's talk about that community competition that you're facing and you're launching into with this asking of $830 million of general obligation bond repayments backed by Miami-Dade County taxpayers. What do your market studies tell you in terms of your expected return on that investment over the lifetime of the bond if you're successful in getting voters to approve it?
Well, here's an example. In that rehab hospital alone, we believe we will have a lift of between $70 and $80 million a year in revenues. Mm-hmm. The urgent care centers we're talking about building 8 to 12 urgent care centers. There are other hospitals that are building them, but as you know, many hospitals are building them in affluent neighborhoods. We're talking about building them in the working class, the middle class. They need urgent care centers as well. So we're not going to compete with all the hospitals that are doing the urgent care, but we're going to put them in neighborhoods that they're not today. Those are also positive cash flow. We're talking about a children's ambulatory center, which we'll build off-campus. By having an off-campus facility, we can make sure that the children that are born here can come back, have their clinical, and continue to work with that. Also, positive cash flow. We think that all these things that we're talking about, including the modernization of the plant, will give us a lift of about $150 to $200 million a year in revenues. That will more than offset the Medicaid, and we're also hoping that the local taxes we receive from the county can then be used for preventive care, which is really a lot of the intent in the future.
With these improvements, you anticipate $150 million in increased revenue on the part of Jackson Health Systems once all these systems are built and put into place. What could be the interest cost of the $830 million in bonds per year? I know you don't know the interest rate yet because you have to go to the market to figure that out, but as you do the financial modeling, what's the cost of this borrowing going to be?
By increasing the millage to the taxpayers are essentially paying for the bond. So the cost will probably be right now, even though we have a slight increase in interest rates right now, we're still at basically almost all-time lows in interest rates when it comes to municipal bonds. So from that perspective, we believe that you're talking in the range of 3.5% to 4.5%, which is relatively low. And although we won't be issuing all those bonds at one time, we'll do them as we need them. And the predominant amount of them will be done in the first 3 to 5 years, because we're talking about the urgency of creating these immediately. Different than most general obligation bonds that counties usually borrow the money over 10 or 20 years, or the school boards like they did last year in Miami-Dade. We're talking about predominant use of this money in the next 3 to 5 years. So the voters and the taxpayers of Miami-Dade County will see the use of this money right away, and we'll see how this money has been segregated and strictly used for Jackson, with an oversight board that will make sure that that happens.
And so what are you asking from a Miami-Dade County homeowner to increase their taxes by, do you think?
The average, meaning if your tax assessed value in your home is an average of $125,000, it will be an average for the next 30 years of $15 a year. If your median home, which is $63,000, that would be $7. And obviously, it'll fluctuate depending on your own tax assessed value of your home.
I have to ask about 2009, the last time Jackson Memorial went into the bond market with an $83 million offering that was backed by revenues from Jackson Memorial. The Securities and Exchange Commission investigated it, and this past fall, the Jackson Health Systems and the Public Health Trust came to an agreement with the SEC to settle some accusations that the SEC found material misstatements in that 2009 bond offering, as well as weak internal controls. What is the message to the public today that you're asking to back up a 10 times greater bond offering than the troubled one that was offered in 2009?
Well, that is a perfect example of what we've done in the last 2.5 years. That same investigation reaffirmed that what we've done in the last 2.5 years are the right things. They talked about what was done in 2009 being wrong. They've also said in that same investigation that the actions we have taken over the last 2.5 years are correct. We have taken, we created accountability, we created the controls that are necessary at Jackson. And for that reason, we went from 2.5 years ago having a Jackson that could have closed any day, because they had lost, as part of that, they had lost over $400 to $500 million over the previous 4 years. Over the last 2.5 years, we have the Jackson being marginally profitable. We made $8 million last year, and this September 30th, we finish our year, we're going to exceed our budget of $36 million. We'll probably be closer to $40 million surplus. But that's not enough to do the improvements that are necessary at Jackson. We have now put the right controls in place. So from that standpoint, what we're asking the public to say, now that we've cured all the sins and we have the right management team, we need to make sure that not only Jackson survives, but it succeeds in the future for the future generations of Miami-Dade County, not just as a public hospital, but as the academic center that it is.
So now that you have positive cash flow and you've been able to turn around the financials since you've come into the administration over the past several years, why not structure this bond deal as backed by Jackson revenue as opposed backed by Miami-Dade County property taxpayers?
That is a great question. The problem that we have is that a revenue bond, which would be one that would be done strictly by Jackson revenues, Jackson does not have sufficient cash flow at this point or historical cash flows to be able to do that. If we waited the 5 or 6 years that it would take for us to prove the revenues of Jackson to do that, we would be way behind with all the urgencies that are coming through with the Medicaid reform and so forth. And frankly, Jackson would probably have such a loss in revenues that I'm not sure we would ever be able to come back from it. And what we'd be forced to do is reduce some of the services that we provide and put the medical school and the academic center at risk.
Carlos Magoya, president of Jackson Health System. You can find more information on our live chat right now online at WLRN.org. Still to come on the Sunshine Economy, that federal investigation into Jackson's last bond deal, that was just part of a new focus by regulators on public debt.
Municipal securities market is something that's grown exponentially. I mean, the size of the outstanding municipal securities today is close to $4 trillion, which obviously it's an extremely large amount.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
We're invested in Port Everglades. We're invested in the Miami-Dade school system. and we're invested in Miami International Airport.
That's Mal Greenfield again from Tallahassee. We introduced you to him at the top of the program. He's the municipal debt investor who's been buying public debt for years. He may live in the Panhandle now, but his wife grew up on Miami Beach, and they lived in South Florida after they got married. They're still invested in the region through public debt. He's one of those bondholders of the public IOUs that he mentioned. But he hasn't lent his money to government agencies here because he feels a special connection. It's about business. He's looking for a return on his money as well as the return of his money.
Location means nothing. It's the actual cash flow that means something. I've never been to Oklahoma in my life, and I have Oklahoma bonds as well.
Eric Bustillo, and I'm the regional director for the Miami Regional Office of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission.
Eric Bustillo wants to make sure Mal Greenfield has accurate information before loaning out his money to a public agency. Bustillo started as an intern in the Miami Regional Office of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He now runs that office as regional director, overseeing stock and bond trading in three states, the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. He's the top federal financial cop in South Florida, and his agency has stepped up its scrutiny of public debt.
The municipal securities market is something that's grown exponentially. I mean, the size of the outstanding municipal securities today is close to $4 trillion, which obviously it's an extremely large amount. Historically, also, municipal issuers are not necessarily required to file registration statements when they want to go ahead and offer municipal securities to the public, and they're not necessarily required to file filings with the commission on an ongoing basis to provide ongoing disclosure.
This is a big difference compared to, say, a company that wants to sell stock to the public. They have to file registration statements, file financial statements, and file them regularly as well as in a timely order. But in order for, a sewer department or a town government to go out and raise money on behalf of the public backed by public taxpayers, they don't necessarily have to do that.
That is correct, Tom. A typical publicly traded company has to register with the commission so that it is required to, on an ongoing basis, typically on a quarterly basis, file reports with the commission that, among other things, include their financial statements as well as other necessary information. When publicly traded companies decide to raise money from the public, unless they fall subject to certain private exemptions, they typically have to file registration statements with the commission. That obviously requires substantial disclosures about the financial condition of the company and a whole host of other very important areas. Municipal issuers don't have to do that. They don't have to file registration statements with the commission, and they don't. They're not required to file quarterly and annual reports with the commission as a publicly traded company would.
Eric, describe to us how the environment to raise money in the public markets on behalf of public taxpayers has changed with this renewed focus that the regulator, in this part the Securities and Exchange Commission, has had.
Well, I mean, from our perspective, we are obviously looking a lot more closely into this space. By that I mean, you know, we are looking to make sure that disclosures that are made at the beginning when these municipal securities are being offered are complete, materially accurate, as well and full, but not only at the time that they're first offered, but we're going to look at their ongoing disclosures with respect to the financial condition of municipalities. I mean, I think it's no secret that in light of the financial crisis that the country has sort of undergone over the past few years, that has put significant strain on many municipalities. Many municipalities, like those in the state of Florida, primarily generate revenue from property taxes. As property values have gone down significantly, the property tax revenue base has gone down significantly. That ultimately means that these municipalities have been receiving a lot less in the way of revenue, which obviously puts strain on their financial condition.
In terms of the policing efforts on the part of the Securities and Exchange Commission for this municipal bond market, the municipal debt, what kind of results do you think the efforts have had as you've intensified the look and the focus that you have on transparency so that the public understands the kind of debt that's being issued in their name and investors understand what's at risk?
I mean, I think through the fairly good number of cases that we brought over the past couple of years, I've been able to see how more and more is written about, you know, our efforts in this area. And I think more and more municipalities are paying attention to the fact that they have to be careful. that they have just as much responsibility to make sure that their disclosures are accurate as any other, you know, company, private company raising money from the public. You know, hopefully they're going to, they understand that they have to make sure that they have systems internally that ultimately are going to promote that their financial disclosure system, you know, lends itself to be, you know, one that ultimately allows them to accurately report their financial condition.
Some of the accusations that you've made against public entities, the city of Miami, city of South Miami, the accusations that were made against Jackson Health Systems with the 2009 bond issue, that particular case has been settled. They do get down to material misstatements, mistakes that were made in the estimation of the regulator, in this case you and your office, Eric, on the part of municipal managers trying to sell these IOUs out in the public. Is there a commonality with these misstatements that the municipalities are making?
So I'll use the city of South Miami and Jackson, you know, as examples a bit, mostly because those are settled. Our city of Miami case is still being litigated, so I'd rather not comment on that since it's pending in the courts. I mean, I would say that, you know, something that we have seen with some consistency is the sort of the lack of internal systems.
What does that mean? Does that mean just accounting software or something more sophisticated?
It could vary. Anything from accounting issues. For example, I think in the Jackson, in the hospital case, we saw that the internal accounting systems that they had to properly assess their accounts receivables and the collectability of these accounts receivables, you know, ultimately caused that they, in essence, understated the loss connected to these accounts receivables by as much as four times. The hospital has indeed taken a number of steps and measures to sort of beef up their internal systems, you know, to make sure to bring people that have sort of the background necessary to make sure that financial disclosures in the future are accurate and things of that nature, and also to have systems that ultimately will allow them to, you know, confidently make sure that their financial disclosures are accurate.
What about the taxpayer that sits behind a number of these bonds? Where do they fit in this regulatory schematic, this new focus that you have and the SEC has on this market?
You know, look, you know, from my perspective, I think to some extent, obviously, taxpayers want to make sure that their municipalities are, you know, judiciously, you know, being stewards of the finances of the particular city. I mean, ultimately, you're basically in a municipality, you're playing with taxpayer money, and so any sort of investigation, any sort of, you know, penalty that may be imposed at the end of the day is one that ultimately is coming out of the taxpayer pocket. So I think the taxpayers, you know, to some degree, have just as much a stake as the investors in these municipal securities.
Eric Bastillo heads up the Securities and Exchange Commission office in South Florida. By the way, that office considered essential for government operations. It remains open during the slowdown. Still to come on the Sunshine Economy, while the federal government may be locked up over debt, remember, that's just the national debt. There's the state government IOUs and pension promises, too.
You need $14.8 billion to pay the bills that have been accumulated so far.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. This week, we will hear a lot about $16.7 trillion. That's the official congressionally mandated borrowing limit for the United States Treasury. It's the national debt ceiling, $16.7 trillion. Money borrowed by the American government and backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. You and me, $16.7 trillion.
The real number we should be focusing on is $74 trillion.
Wait, $74 trillion? From just below $17 trillion to $74 trillion? That's Sheila Weinberg. She is the founder and CEO of Truth in Accounting, a nonpartisan group pushing for governments of all sizes in the U.S. to produce what it calls, quote, financial reports that are understandable, reliable, transparent, and correct, end quote. So how does she figure the national public debt is closer to $74 trillion?
I always answer that question with a question. Do you believe that our veterans and seniors are owed the benefits that they have been promised?
Weinberg's accounting of the national public debt includes the financial promises made by Social Security, Veterans Affairs, and other entitlement programs. After all, they're called entitlement programs. So Weinberg figures they should be included in the red ink.
We spoke with Weinberg via Skype from her office in Chicago.
The $74 trillion includes the benefits that have been already promised to our seniors in the form of Social Security and Medicare, and the retirement benefits that have been promised to our veterans and civil service employees. And, you know, that number is easy to, you know, comprehend. All each taxpayer needs to do is send a check for $250,000 to the Treasury Department, and we would be all set.
If we send that check to the U.S. Treasury, that only gets rid of the federal public debt. That doesn't do anything to the state and local government debt that we've incurred on our behalf, does it?
No, and what, you know, taxpayers need to focus on is that, you know, there are numerous taxing entities that they're responsible for. So they're responsible, obviously, for the federal government, then for their state government, for their county governments, for their city governments, and maybe their park districts. There's numerous taxing entities that they have possible liability for.
Sheila, give us a sense of what the general state of the municipal debt load is, the public debt load beyond the federal government.
Well, what we've done is studied the state level, and we found that as of 2012, the latest data available, the states need $1.3 trillion to pay the bills that they have accumulated already.
On top, you still have local governments, school districts, park entities, and other government entities that have issued public bonds, right?
Right. There in Florida, we found that you need $14.8 billion to pay the bills that have been accumulated so far.
A lot of public debt is issued, but it can be backed by toll roads, or it's issued to build, in the case of Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport, a new runway, or what Jackson Health Systems wants to do here in Dade County, modernize emergency rooms. So there's physical assets backing these. You're really taking into account the debt that has essentially been promised in the future on the part of pension and health care obligations.
We are not including, in essence, mortgage debt, because what we do is we remove the capital assets, just like you wouldn't sell your house to pay your current bills. We don't believe that the state should, you know, sell their roads or their buildings to pay their bills. So we take that out of our calculations, and then we remove the debt related to those capital assets. So we're not including the mortgage in our calculations. We're only including, in essence, their credit card debt.
There seems to be no shortage of lenders out there, of investors who want their money to be put to work by state and local governments.
The public doesn't have the information they need to hold their governments accountable, because they've actually been spending more tax dollars than they have been receiving. And all of this is going to be pushed on to future taxpayers who are going to have to pay these debts. If the public, again, Tom, if you understood that the governments were going into debt every single year instead of balancing their budget, then you might make a different decision on who to elect or not elect.
Still to come on the Sunshine Economy, as a Floridian, our state's credit is better than that of the entire country's. This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. As Americans, our credit rating is considered AA. It's not the highest. It was knocked down back in the summer of 2011, the last time there was a showdown in Washington over the debt ceiling. But as Floridians, our credit rating is better, AAA, a notch above the rating of the entire nation. Tolu Olorunipa covers the state government for Bloomberg News. He joined us from Tallahassee.
Well, it does definitely say something about how we're doing here in Florida. We have we've seen our economy start to rebound. We've seen our tax revenue start to increase, and we've also started to pay down some of our debt. So some of the rating agencies have recognized that, and they believe Florida is back on track, and they've given us a good rating because of that.
Another interesting thing about Florida, of course, is with no personal state income tax, there's not a diversified revenue stream in business speak going into Tallahassee. In other words, there's, you know, it's basically property taxes. A lot of that stays local. So with this high credit rating, is that a credit to prudent spending or, again, like just improved business climate?
It's a little bit of both. We have definitely reined in our spending and kept the cap on some of the spending, and For critics, that they would say we're not spending enough on social services like education and those types of things. But we are getting a lot of money from state sales taxes, and that has a lot to do with how much people are spending at the grocery store, how many tourists are coming from out of town and buying, buying goods here in Florida. I think about 3/4 of our state revenue comes from state sales taxes. And, we don't have an income tax, but most of our revenue is coming from, just purchases on regular goods.
Yeah. And so that ties kind of the state finances almost directly to consumer confidence. It also ties it, obviously, to kind of, at least here in South Florida, the international flavor of consumers that come to South Florida and leave their money behind. So how volatile could this get as, we await this debt showdown in Washington this week?
It's a good point. It depends very much on how the economy goes and if all the predictions about another recession or, a slowed economy because of the problems in Washington, if those pan out, that could definitely trickle down here in Florida. We, rely a lot on tourism. We rely a lot on state sales taxes. And if people aren't confident about the economy and they're not spending money, if, retirees aren't buying goods, then that's going to slow down our economy. It's going to slow down our tax revenue.
Governor Scott has made an issue of this credit rating and also job growth. How big of an issue is this going to be as we move into the gubernatorial race in 2014?
It seems like it's going to be a central issue, especially if Governor Scott has his way. He wants to talk a lot about how there's been a turnaround. State debt was increasing for about 20 years before 2010. And over the last 3 years, state debt has started to decrease. He wants to use that as an example of his fiscal conservatism, his stewardship of the state, and his ability to make smart financial decisions. Of course, there are other interpretations, and folks say that we're not spending enough on education. During Scott's first year, we cut a lot of money out of education. Other services have also been cut. State workers have been reduced. We have reduced overall state debt, but we have some sort of some debt that we don't count as part of state debt. Things like citizens' property insurance and the catastrophe fund. Every time there's a hurricane season, we borrow money. And that's actually been increasing. So there are various arguments out there. We are borrowing more money. We are refinancing a lot of our old debt. We aren't, just paying down debt. We are also borrowing to balance our books.
That's Tolola Ranipa with Bloomberg News in Tallahassee. You can read Standard & Poor's credit rating, that AAA credit rating of the Sunshine State bonds. You can find that link on our website at WLRN.org. This is the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN. Clearly, there's a lot of different types of public debt and IOUs, and they're paid back in a number of different ways. But these IOUs, it's important to remember, are issued in the public's interest. It's issued in our names. So it's up to us as voters to make the accounting accountable at the ballot box. This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. There was nothing.